I'm Stargate Pioneer.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Lauren from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D.
A podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts
at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio, now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 112 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we look back fondly on 12 weeks of drama, intrigue, terror, relationships, humor, loss, truth, lies, suspense, and action, and ask ourselves, what do you mean that's it until Christmas? I'm your host, Haley Malley, and joining me this week in the GPR studios is Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
I am outstanding. I am still surviving. I am still enjoying being a Whovian.
We'll see you again next week, I guess, where you're at.
Flipping the coin.
And also with me this week is Jay Witten. How are you today, Jay?
All right, so I've had the shakes, I've had the vomiting, I've had the depression. How many more symptoms do I have in this withdrawal?
Have you had the runs?
So we've been through 12 weeks that have run the gamut of subtle to world-shattering, and now we sit here breathless and exhausted on the other side of an 8th series of Doctor Who. We're obligated to do what all good fans do, and that's to tear it down to its minutiae and get a fuller understanding of what we've just spent the last 3 months scrutinizing. Would the listening world expect any less?
Not from us.
We've witnessed the arrival of the latest incarnation of our titular character, along with the upheaval and unknowns that are both directed towards him as a character and his portraying actor, Peter Capaldi, and have watched with equal interest at the way that writers, producers, and particularly our showrunner have dealt with the most unexpected change in casting and tone at what would arguably be a peak global popularity of the Doctor Who franchise. Crack out those red pens, because it's grading week.
Back to Coal Hill School. How appropriate.
We've got marking to do.
Yeah. Well, we've been adding to our sort of list as every episode aired this season. We've been sort of discussing the series as it was building around us, and going over our what we consider the highs and lows. We kind of figured as a proper recap, we should be sort of looking back at the season as a whole and try and determine whether or not it hit some of the points that it had set out to do, terms of what Moffat and company had said back in, summer of last year, what they were setting us out to expect, and how they delivered, and just the structure of the series itself and see how our story arcs and character arcs played out and, what the general consensus is about how the viewing public feels about it.
Let's take a look at the things that the Moffat camp had actually put out and said that this series was meant to accomplish. We'd heard it said by pretty much everyone involved that this was going to be a darker series, that this was going to be a darker Doctor, that things were going to be far more intense than they had been recently.
Right. Yeah. And they use the term alien, too. The Doctor was going to be far more alien again, a return to the alien Doctor, I guess.
Right.
Right, which we commented on that, especially early in the season. Just the way he was interacting with humans was different than what we'd seen in recent years.
Mm. Right. Yeah, and then, they said that they were going to break away from the quirky, attractive young man with expressive hair. I love that quote. And Moffat had said that,
concerned about with this kind of a casting change and just a directional shift for the show was not actually new for the show at all. If there was a concern that it was becoming sort of formulaic in the last couple of seasons, insofar as, having your dashing younger title character, who would, be there to cling to and rely on in the thick of things, and instead we're going towards a slightly erratic, older lead character who you're not really certain whether he cares about you or just keeps you around because of some sort of strange sense of obligation or the fact that he can't seem to shake you to go off and do what he needs to do. But that's nothing really new. Mm-hmm. It's just new to the post-2005 set of the series. So kind of what's old is new again, I guess. Pun intended.
Yeah. You know, it's, I felt like all of the points that we had highlighted here were really hit. I mean, we definitely got the darker tones, the more, you know, almost horror themed elements of the show. You know, I mean, going back to Listen and Flatline, like there were some genuinely disturbing moments in there. You know, like Haley said, you know, the Doctor absolutely was very alien, especially through the first half of the series. Yeah, mm-hmm. There was a constant, well, you know, why can't you understand simple humanity kind of thing? You know, then the obviously very different than anything we'd seen in recent years. So it definitely got that. And mm-hmm. I mean, there were moments where the show genuinely was surprising. Some that were supposed to be that were kind of predictable, but for the most part, I felt it like it was, there were moments that actually were rather surprising.
Mm-hmm. They did also scale far back on the lighthearted romp mm-hmm. aspects of the show that had become really pervasive, particularly during the Smith era, because of the fact that it suited him so well to be able to be that affable, you know, very kind of Scooby-Doo and Shaggy-esque kind of capers that they would get into, because it was genuinely entertaining. I'm not saying that it wasn't. I'm not taking anything away from the entertainment value of it, but if that was something where it was taking a precedent that had started really being explored in the RTD range with Tennant and then just became intensified with Smith, simply because you had a working cast that was so good at executing that. From a production standpoint, and I think that's kind of what Moffat was saying or was alluding to at that point, was, you know, when you realize that you have done something new and that newness becomes predictable or formulaic, it's time to shake things down its roots.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had maybe Sherwood as one of the only attempts to really just kind of keep it light and fluffy. Well, I don't know, Forest of the Night, maybe, to a certain degree.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think that was almost like an old school fairy tale where there was actual danger. You know, there was that sense of fear and the general danger, but it wasn't an overwhelming suspense thriller.
Right, but there was that bit at the end where everyone thought they were going to die.
Minor.
Yeah.
But see, and that's what I mean about the old school fairy tales, when they were actually meant to, you know, to teach children's things and, you know, like, hey, pay attention, the world's a dangerous place.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or, hey, trust in science in this case, or our version of science for the moment.
Not the actual science. That stuff's bogus. Yeah.
Swiance.
So if there is a, you know, like if you're looking at the program or looking at the series as a business, you know, and you're sitting there at a producer's table or screenwriter's gathering, and they're going through the structure of what they're going to be laying out. They've got that's why I kind of treat it as like a mission statement. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it you're setting out to do? But the way you go about executing that, or what it is that you're trying to convey, your message or what have you, that's your theme for the season. And there are a couple, I think, that were really kind of rising to the surface that we kept bringing up over and over and over. So I mentioned this last week as something that I wanted to kind of throw at the two of you and see if we can kind of take this apart a bit. And that has to do with that whole balance of truth and lies and when and why the decision to use one or the other is being done. Because a lot of people were using truth or lies as their one word descriptor of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your kind of pull from this as far as the way that is an undercurrent for the vast majority of this season?
Really, more than anything, it was Clara's story was about her use of truth and lies throughout the season, more than anybody else in the show.
Okay. But it, to what end? Like, what was it justified for her character, or, you know, or for where her character is at this point in her development?
You know, the lies that she was telling throughout the season, where she was lying to Danny about traveling with the Doctor and lying to Doctor about Danny's opinion on her traveling with him, that part I felt was not justified. But at the end, when she's lying to protect him, that feels more justified than her earlier lies.
Okay.
Yeah, it definitely had I mean, that's something that we've kind of gotten over the past few years is, you know, rule number one, the doctor lies. Well, the doctor's not the only one that lies. And now we're seeing how that really plays in with everyone else, too. And it's a great example of how, you know, how quickly lies can snowball, too. Because you've got this lie, well, you have to carry that lie forward, and, you know, then you've got to make other lies to make that lie stick, and you've got to cover it up, and it just taints every interaction that you have with that person from that point forward, you know, until things get resolved. So this was a great way of beginning to build that tension between Clara and Danny, between Clara and the doctor, you know, and have something that was constantly underlining everything that happened. And, right. You know, you're constantly waiting for that point to break when they realize you've been lying to me this whole time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what I had noticed was that the lies to any great length were persistent throughout, among all of our principal characters. You know, the doctor and Clara had been, if not outright dishonest with one another, at least withholding information from one another throughout the series. But the reasons and the justifications for those omissions or deceptions or whatever it was at the moment shifted at some point or over some gradual point over the course of mid-season. So, you know, I sort of brought this up last week. It's like, you know, when they were first trying to figure each other out, Clara didn't really understand the regeneration process and she was being coached through it by Vostra and Jenny. And for episodes to follow, really didn't know exactly who it was that she was traveling with or dealing with or conversing with at any given moment. And so that trust factor was very, very frail.
Yeah.
But by the same token, the doctor looking upon her didn't really know what to rely on because as soon as he started to try to utilize her as a tether to things that he could understand or sort out, there was always the undercurrent of the disdain towards humans, of which she was just part and parcel, mm-hmm. And that alien nature, so that distrust factor. So he was withholding lots of information from her in terms of what his intentions or his reasonings or the logic of which he was dealing with any situations. But they were doing so because they didn't know one another and therefore didn't trust one another with the full truth or all information. At some point, though, this teeter-totter tilts. And you get to the point where they genuinely do think that they know one another well enough to know what truths or what complete shares of information could be harmful to them and they're better off not knowing, in their opinion. So I almost want to go back and do a rewatch simply to figure out where that tipping point occurs, if it is that stark of one.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I mean, it would take going back and actually watching specifically for that because it was such a just pervasive part of the entire series that it's hard to pick a point out and be like, this is the tipping point. I mean, obviously we had the moment when the doctor realized that Clara had been lying to him about, you know, Danny being okay with her traveling and things like that. But I don't know when the actual change in the dynamic would have been.
An interesting kind of question to piggyback on that is who came over to the other first? In terms of who finally said, okay, this is someone that I can put stock in. You know, because we think that there are points where Clara has come around and she understands that the doctor, for all of his gruff demeanor and unusual ways, really does have her best interests at heart. But then, you know, something happens and she kind of calls it into question again. We don't really get a real clear, vocalized, cut and dry point where we know that the doctor genuinely cares until he outright says it about the whole betrayal line. You know, about the, do you think so little of me?
Yeah.
You know, that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was there any point where he really openly expresses his care and concern for her prior to that?
No, but this doctor doesn't express care and concern for anybody.
That's right. A valid point.
So the fact that he does say it outright means 10 times as much.
Right. He doesn't show open disdain for her. That's as cuddly as he gets.
I mean, honestly, the closest I can think to something like that happening before was at the end of Flatline when he tells her, you were a fantastic doctor. I mean, that's a huge compliment coming from him. Mm. But that's not an admission of genuine heartfelt compassion.
Right. Or empathy, for that matter.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times when she looks like she's in, you know, where she's going through an emotional ringer, and he's oblivious to it.
Yeah.
Maybe not to the degree of like being a sociopath and having no feeling whatsoever, but damn close at times.
Yeah, yeah.
Another one of the themes running throughout the season is the whole idea of knowledge or being in full knowledge of situations or of understandings. Now, granted, this is a show that's based on mystery elements, mm-hmm. you know, having these unknowns. But I guess you can ask yourself every once in a while, is it advantageous to have all the information laid out in front of you so that you can figure out what your moves and your strategies are? Or is there a benefit to having unknowns because they drive you to continue? So it's the idea of, you know, every time you close one door, another one opens.
Yeah. I mean, this was a big part of, you know, there always seemed to be a shortage of knowledge when it came to certain aspects. You know, the Doctor was constantly in a state of catch up almost through this whole thing. And, you know, especially when it came to Missy, when all of that came out, he was completely clueless going into it. And the whole two-part finale was him trying to gain an understanding of what it was that was going on.
And that had apparently been going on for quite some time without him being even remotely aware.
Right, right. Yeah, so, you know, and then Clara, with Clara, I don't think it was so much knowledge that was driving her as it was an understanding and trying to find the balance, basically. Maybe, you know, trying to gain the knowledge she needed to figure out how to get that, but I don't know. I feel like I'm stretching at some point.
Well, no, but that actually gets us right into the next segment that we want to start to look at, and that's obviously anytime you're going to be dealing with a show that has such an intricacy of character interaction, you've got character arcs and story arcs that you really want to explore and see how well they carried us as a viewer. Because if you've got characters obviously that stay completely flat, then there's no impetus to want to see anything happen to them because they haven't endeared themselves to us. Or if it's story arc that has really compelling characters, but they're not doing anything of interest, then there's no threat and therefore it loses some of its energy. So some of the arcs that we had to deal with for this series, you started going into one, the whole idea of the living the two lives. That Clara had to come to terms with. That was set up when we first start to get that laid out for us. That's in.
I mean, I feel like it really started with the first episode that Danny showed up in, wasn't it?
Right, when she went on the date with him and kept coming back to it from other places in her timeline.
Mm. So was that was Listen that first happened in, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, episode four then, but it pretty much kept on hitting on all of the episodes after that too.
Right, incrementally. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, there's a point where we get sort of a dating montage to speed us through their relationship a little bit, and it's actually something for anybody who kind of felt that they were cheated out of having more opportunity to see Danny and Clara's relationship develop. Well, it was all there, but it just happened inside of about 16 seconds. So
yeah,
MTV style.
You know, the freak shower. Mm. Seaweed.
She said freak. I said,
but as far as, you know, that brings up an interesting point. So the whole idea of having the two lives, and this goes back to our idea of the truth and lies theme, pervasive throughout. Do we feel that by the time we came to the series conclusion, did we get a good culmination to that arc? As far as seeing the way that she was trying to keep the two sides of her life separate, either intentionally or through deception at times, was that executed well?
I kind of feel so, because it showed just how devastating those results can be. You know, when you divide your time between two different things, neither one of them gets the attention it deserves. And that just got proven when, you know, with the whole
Danny gets hit by a car
splat thing. You know,
so let that be a lesson to you, kids.
Yeah, I mean, it showed that, you know, you don't get a happy ending when you do something like that. You know, lying to two people and trying to keep both of them in the dark and, you know, living a life of deception probably won't end well.
Right. But in the end, when she was forced to finally make a choice, she chose Danny. It was just, you know, a little too late for that to make a whole lot of difference.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, what else have we got as far as arcs for the series?
Well, I mean, some of the other things that we got was the whole Promised Land. You know, starting from Deep Breath, having the half-faced man, you know, searching for the Promised Land and murdering half of London to do it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of general satisfaction with that carrot being held out in front of us for the series, when you finally got your explanation on that, that we were dealing with sort of an AI state within that matrix slice, is that an answer that you're satisfied with?
Yes, because I wouldn't have want them to go with like a more mystical answer to that.
Oh no, I absolutely agree. I don't think that the show needs the whole afterlife. This is not supernatural.
Yeah, no, it's
right.
You definitely didn't need that, but I really felt like that. I was sitting there wondering, like, okay, what about all the droids that were searching for? Like, what's? It didn't really have that nice bow on the end of it. It was just kind of like, hey, look, we're mentioning this to set up the mystery later on so that we can bring all these elements in the finale, but we're not really ever going to talk about these again. They're just here to, you know, to lay the seeds.
You mean as far as those individuals who were pulled in over the course of the series?
Yeah, I mean, we never saw the half-faced man again. We don't know, you know, even why an AI would be searching out the Promised Land. It was never explicitly stated why this was such a draw for robotic beings. You know, we never saw what came of the girl into the Dalek. I mean, we can assume she was one of the Cybermen, but like, you know, why? Like, it's just, I didn't have as much of a problem with. It was the whole robotic beings that, you know, were searching for this place that I didn't understand why that was such a.
I had taken that because of the fact that they had actually achieved sentience to a certain degree, and therefore they were a viable consciousness that could have been downloaded into the Nethersphere just like any other. So it was, it could be utilized.
Okay, that's a possibility. Just something, an intelligence to start controlling the shell, basically.
Right, and but could Missy have used those for Cybermen since they didn't have any meat to go into a cybersuit?
Well, no, you'd use another corpse on the planet. But the whole idea is to put the willing consciousness in there that had already given itself up to upgrading. So it's you needed the two pieces. I mean, you got a viable piece of meat down there on the surface, and then you've got a data bank full of consciousnesses that have given themselves over to be to live again, as far as they know.
So what you're saying is, I was waving my hand wrong. It's not like this. It's I do it this way, and it all goes.
You got to use your left hand to do the hand wavy part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just going to smack yourself in the forehead.
All right. So, what were some of the other arcs that we had going? The whole Danny story, you know, with him in his first episode crying when somebody said, "Did you kill someone?" and that being played out throughout the entire series.
Doctor's disdain for soldiers and whether or not a true soldier has the heart within him to be anything of value other than just a trigger.
I still, after the whole season, feel like the Doctor's disdain for soldiers came out of nowhere just to serve the story this season.
It was a little forced.
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
Brusque. If there were some incident, you know, leading into, you know, how we've talked about the fact that that regenerations take on some characteristics that are indicative of the pressures that the predecessor had faced. It's a reactionary regeneration process. If that were the case, I would have understood a little better. But there was nothing really overt within the Smith era that would have said, all right, we need to explore this in depth because there's some issues here, because there really weren't. I mean, you get into Good Man Goes to War and those issues, and he's right alongside Unit or whatever the case may be. And it wasn't an issue.
Yeah, no, it wasn't until, oh, look, here's another soldier that, you know, is vying for Claire's attention. And then, you know, he just hates soldiers in general. So it did almost feel like a plot device at that point. Or it could have just been an intricacy of this Doctor's regeneration. I mean, why was 10 so, you know, focused on being a ginger? And, you know, why did the fourth Doctor have such a penchant for jelly babies? It could just be a part of his...
A quirk
his,
of the process?
Yeah, just a part of his personality that's just, no, I know I've worked with soldiers before, but I really don't like the way they think. Yes. You know, it could be.
By the way, I'm gonna halt you right there. Patrick Troughton actually introduced Jelly.
Well, I know, but the.
sorry, I'm so sorry.
All right. And then, what about the whole good man aspect of it? Yeah, you know, we had that very early on. I mean, that was in all the trailers and everything. Is the Doctor asking, "Am I a good man?"
This is one I think carried very well throughout. This was touched on in nearly every episode to some degree, or at least was something that you could tell that the subtext was there that was driving some of the Doctor's decisions, a lot of his interactions with characters, both human and non, and just some of his more introspective moments as well. And I personally really like the way that this was executed, because it was the fact that it started out as being a genuine question, and then it became something where he actually sort of pushed against it, because the process of trying to analyze it within himself, he could tell that it was getting in the way of dealing with situations at hand. And then when it finally gets thrust back in his face again, in the case of the Mistress, really using that whole idea of goodness as a crutch, or in a certain case as a fault, he has now been able to stare intently at it and back away from it sufficiently enough to come to the conclusion that he does, where it's not the pursuit of being labeled as a good man that's going to determine, you know, how you rest within others' eyes. You know, you may have all of your intentions in the world. If you're pursuing them for the right reasons, whether, you know, the good or the bad things result of that, you are still going at it for what you consider to be a proper moral imperative. So, really well executed in the dialogue, too.
Yeah, this was one of those storylines that I feel like they addressed exactly the right number of times in enough different ways. You know, they directly addressed it, and they addressed it a little more obliquely. And I was really happy with the resolution that they had at the end of the season.
Yeah. When he realizes he's an idiot.
Yes. Yes. Good man, bad man. No, idiot.
Yeah, absolutely. So I felt like it was one of those things that you constantly were asking yourself along with him. And even when he wasn't asking it, you knew that was something that was going on in his mind. So I felt like this aspect of it was very well done and worked seamlessly throughout it. So very, very good storytelling in that aspect.
Right. And Haley, I got to agree with you on the point where you're saying about just enough mention of it.
Right.
Whereas I know you personally took a lot of umbrage to the whole Promised Land arc because of the fact that it didn't give you enough or shut up about it enough.
Right.
To keep you on either side.
I still feel that way. Like, I wish they had either addressed it a little less or had some subtle references in a couple more episodes.
Mm. So that it didn't just get dumped on us for two episodes at the end.
I can get that. Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't need like the whole Missy at the end of the episode talking to whoever died in that week's episode to be addressing it. Just something, some subtle reference or something in a couple more episodes is what I wanted.
Okay. Do you think that something like the, you know, speaking in terms of like the breadcrumbs of mystery characters, do you think like the Madame Kavarian was better executed as far as her just popping up through a, you know,
to just boggle your mind, like what is going on?
Would that have been a better sort of execution?
Maybe, or maybe somebody who we didn't see later with Missy mentioning, you know, the Promised Land or the Nether Sphere or something.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not a writer. I just know what I like and what I don't like.
That makes sense.
I like things I like.
I don't know how to fix it, but fix it.
It's a battle cry of every Whovian. So what were some of the production aspects? Let's take a look at that. Some of the scripts and stuff, and just the things that went on behind the scene that really we felt added to or maybe took away from things.
Well, I think we're all in agreement that there was more evidence that the writing team and the screenwriting process was tighter.
Yeah.
This series, and that there was a lot more communication, or maybe just a common hand in the editing process to ensure that there was better flow between the episodes. I think arrangement of the episodes, sequencing of the episodes was much better than it's been in the last series or so.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, right. You could definitely see that, especially with, like, you know, Robot of Sherwood being almost lighthearted goofiness, and then it came way down to listen. Mm-hmm. You know, and right before that, you had Into the Daleks. So you needed that break to just kind of catch your breath before dumping back into a really tense episode.
Oh, could you imagine those two back to back instead?
Oh, geez, no.
It'd be a rough series.
Oh, man, yeah. So, I mean, as much as we crapped on it, I mean, Robot of Sherwood was absolutely needed right there.
Yeah.
Granted,
yeah.
A better script would have been more, you know, but...
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people felt like with Series 7B, they were just like, okay, you're going to take this script and you take that one. And everyone went to their own offices and did their episode, and then they just put them all together.
Yeah.
This one feels like, you know, once a week they came together and were like, okay, weekly meeting, What's everyone up to? Oh, hey, no, you can't do that because of what's going to happen next week. Mm-hmm. You know, last week or last year felt very modular as far as the episodes were concerned.
You could have dropped them in anywhere in any order and not had any problem at all. Yeah, that was one of the main complaints that we had, too, was that it felt like Moffat needed to have a stronger hand on it and oversee the entire process instead of just saying, hey, can you put this 3 minutes on the end of your episode? Yeah, that's great. That's all you need. Yeah,
and it was more than just... It was more than just continuity, because that's not, it wasn't necessarily that there were gaps in continuity, but it was a matter of just the
consistency of tone and characters.
Yeah, the way the series congealed. Yeah, and I felt like a lot of the terms that I heard being used to refer to the season were things like tight, well-stitched, focused was another word that came up a lot. And it's just a matter of seeing that the team, as you said, was not working in separated cubicles and would just, throw their finished script into a manila envelope and ship it off, wait for their check to arrive. They actually did confer with one another from time to time. Also, big, big kudos to Jamie Matheson for just killing it this season. I can't wait to see if they're going to give more opportunities for writing some additional episodes in 9.
Oh, here's hoping.
Yeah.
All right. So what about the music and the sound effects? I mean, I can't remember a series that had such complaints about I couldn't hear what was being said over the music.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, they,
so,
but
I remember one other show, but it was like cable sci-fi in the 90s is the only other time I've heard complaints like that.
Well, I mean, yeah, but there were other moments where the sound was absolutely perfect. Where, especially in Dark Water, I remember when actually it was the lack of sound that was so effective when Danny got hit and you cut back to Clara and it was just complete silence. Mm-hmm. And then other moments where the music was very understated, but very, very effective.
Right. As far as what Marigold has composed for this season, I've been extremely entertained with it. I can't wait until I can get a hold of the isolated score, mm-hmm. On CD or digital format, because you could tell, 8 bars or 16 bars into any piece exactly what episode it was coming from. And if you didn't know the actual episode, you could at least tell, oh, this was that heist one, because this is that kind of, this is that groovy thing, or from Forest of the Night, everything had that kind of a once upon a time sort of over-exaggerated fairy tale feel, or even elements of lots of French horns and things for Sherwood, because, freaking Robin Hood.
Yeah.
So as far as matching, each of these episodes had very, very distinct characteristics to the feel and the tone of the episode itself, and the music adapted very well to it. If we want to talk about the mix down, though, that's a different issue.
Right. That's where most of the problems came from.
Yeah, the music was fantastic. It's just they didn't always have the volume set right. And then a couple of the early episodes had that weird new soundboard. Yeah, somebody got a new soundboard and they just had to use it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jeannie. Nothing ever came from that.
And all I can think of is if any of you watch Bob's Burgers. So Eugene with his keyboard is just testing out new effects. So every once in a while there's just a random boing or a dog barking or a fart noise or something in there just because he wants to use it. So
yeah, but one thing
the fart noise would have made sense because I can see the doctor sneaking a whoopee cushion under somebody's chair.
Oh, God, that would be great to have something like that come from Capaldi.
Pardon his humor. He's Scottish. They think it's funny.
One thing I did notice, though, is that we didn't have any of those, the really in-your-face, scores from Marigold this season. There was no I Am the Doctor music. There was no Rings of Akatan. All of the music was very, in the background, unless the mix got mixed up.
Peter Capaldi also didn't have his Sermon on the Mount the way Smith did.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Closest he got was just in the final episode.
An idiot.
Without the womp, 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 womp in the background.
Because they took away the soundboard.
Damn it.
You've abused the privilege.
I chucked it in the bin. But all right, speaking in terms of effects, and flip down around to the other side now. Now we're going to talk about the visual effects aspect of it as far as its execution. Mm-hmm. Since we didn't have too many grand scenes, we didn't go up against any sun gods or anything this season. But we did have things like the nethersphere effect, looking across the spherical interior of mm-hmm. the AI there. The Cybermen invasion.
Yeah.
And rising from the graves. I thought that was really well executed. There's some other moments that, as far as did the Skullbox Blitzer work for you guys?
I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't one of those things that I'm going to have nightmares about. It's just like, oh, look, they put some guy in a goofy suit.
That was feeling very RTD to me, as far as villains and threats go. The idea of the glowy eyed robo monster.
Yeah. Well, but see, that one was actually done really effectively because it was there, it served a purpose, and it wasn't built up to be anything more than it was, which was basically just a plot device. You know, you needed some threat to actually, you know, get things going, and it served that purpose, and they didn't need it for anything else. So, yeah, it did have a very RTD kind of feel to it in terms of, like, the look and things like that. But, but now the use of it was brilliantly done.
Mm, yeah, very much so. I know we were really, impressed, but surprised by the effect use in Flatline.
Yeah.
As far as the idea of the playing with dimensional representation and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I think on the whole, I don't think there were any points during this series where the effects pulled me out of an episode.
No.
Even Into the Forest of the Night, where it could have gotten very outlandish very quickly.
No, everything that needed to be big and flashy was done really well, and things that just needed to be background pieces pretty much were. It worked well. I mean, you think about even back in Deep Breath, the Half-Faced Man. I mean, I love the effects work that they did on him. That was fantastic.
I think the only thing, actually, I'm going to retract a little bit. The only thing that I think was any point where I did kind of push back from the table a little bit was Kill the Moon when the shuttle crashed on lunar surface.
Yeah.
That felt a little
hokey, but that was a little plasticky.
Yeah. Yeah, but then the space dragon butterfly thing cracking out of the moon was actually, it was done faint enough that it actually did kind of work. Like, you might not have bought into the premise, but the look of it was actually accomplished fairly well.
Right.
Off in the distance, slightly out of focus.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, okay, fine, crash the shuttle behind a ship, so all you have to add is dust effects, but that's fine. But, you know, when you do something like that, they did it really well. So what about some of the other villains and monsters we had this series? Some of the ones that stand out are the Teller from Time Heist. Yeah, the Minotaur that everyone knew was coming back this series.
I know a number of people who consider Time Heist to be one of the highlights of the series, for a lot of aspects, but the Teller in particular, because of the fact that it's your rubber suit monster for the week. But again, it's another one where you get to deal with the monster, the misrepresented or maltreated monster that you end up having compassion for at the end, and two of them get to run off.
happily ever after.
I swear I've seen
their
this
little,
before.
What was little that? Nubby tails.
you know what their tails reminded me of? Do you remember the alien that you see first in Men in Black? The Mickey or whatever it was? The big blue alien, and it turns around at one point and has all these flippers that come up, and I swear to God, they use the same prosthetic for the tails on those things.
I'm going to have to go back and watch. I honestly don't know about Mickey the blue prosthetic alien.
Sorry, it was in the first like 5 minutes of the movie. It just, for some reason, I remember those little flippers popping up off.
You're making me realize I haven't seen that movie recently enough.
Wasn't the first 5 minutes, wasn't that the alien that gave birth in the back of the car?
No,
that was later.
No, this was before Will Smith ever showed up. Oh. The Mexicans in the truck and the goo all over the forest.
Oh, that's right. I forgot how that movie started. Good grief.
It started with a fly.
I'm going to need a corner off both of your geek cards.
Mine doesn't have corners.
it's done Battlestar Galactica style. They've all been nipped off. Wow, we're just crossing the streams all over the place here. Okay, so villains and monsters. Yeah, the boneless.
Great monsters, horrible name.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Even though their name was called out to them, I name you Boneless. Not to be confused with Toothless. The other one, here on Burke.
The purple face laser robots and Robots of Sherwood.
Purple face laser robots. I think it was a beautiful design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And something that I think they would have killed for back in the mid-80s when they did other robo monsters.
Yeah. Oh, dear God. Can we send them back there? They'd actually be fantastic back then.
I don't know. You know, when you think about...
You can't cross your own time screen. So
you think about robots in the history of this franchise, and obviously one of the most iconic ones is the one from the self-titled, or from the titled episode, Robot, you know, Baker's first episode. Terrence Dix himself said that that is his favorite monster, his favorite creature done on the show before or since. He loves that robot. Loves the design of it. Loves the fact that he modeled it after King Kong because he wanted it to be a misunderstood character that you had to empathize with. So I went to the teller this time around. But just, you know, and I keep looking at pictures of this thing with its weird stained glass forehead and whatnot and think, you know, that was a pretty cool idea. It just, you know, the capabilities of the fabrication at the time didn't allow it to be quite as menacing as it could have been. But if they put that into the hands of a crew today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with the giant claws and whatnot, they could have had a field day with it.
Very much so.
So,
you know, and it's very ironic, but one of the quote-unquote villains or monsters that stands out to me is from Listen.
And the one we didn't see.
Exactly. And, I mean, this just goes to show, like, leaving things up to the imagination can be far better than anything even the most talented special effects artists can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, I think back on scary Doctor Who villains, and this is up there. And I, you know, we don't even know if there was one. That's the great part. You know, and it's just, that's one of those things when you realize it's like, okay, sometimes a scary monster is great to drive the plot, but sometimes just the threat of one is even better.
Right. Sorry, effects teams.
You guys get the week off. Unpaid.
We're going to put this blanket over this kid's head. Put him slightly out of focus in the background. Creepy, right?
All right, so let's talk about the big one. So what did we think of Missy?
She was perfect in every possible
practically
way.
Practically perfect, yes.
Bananas!
Like the original episode 4 theatrical release. Perfect. Don't change it. Yeah, I think as far as even before the penny dropped, and you knew exactly who you were dealing with, as soon as they started allowing her for longer scene work and giving her the dialogue to play with and just saying, here's a plate full of scenery. Have at it. The fork and the knife. I have to say that from the production photos that they were putting out previously didn't do justice to the bat guano delivery that she was about to bring to the character, because all you got was the weird stark makeup and the staring contests with Capaldi in the streets and such. And until you got to see those things really carried out, you could tell that this was a wholly new, just as the doctor's persona within a certain box, you're always dealing with the doctor, but you are getting a different doctor every time. This is a very different master than anything we've had before, but it is definitely still every bit of the malice and madness that is the master.
Yeah. And I mean, she brought a great new take to it. She really did. Just this is one of those moments when the master was really, truly threatening again. You know, everything from the scene that is going to stick with me for a very, very long time is when she killed Osgood. And that's right. One of the reasons why I hope that as horrible as it was, I want that death to stick, because that was hard. That was hard to get through.
Yeah, and well, because she goes from being like whimsically silly to straight up murder and then right back to whimsically silly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, her movements when she, you know, when the doctor came down and she asked, you know, do you have any more friends I can play with? And she does the little marionette, like waving her arms back and forth. And I was just like, that is messed up. Like, for some reason, that movement with what she said was just horrifying.
And I'm willing to bet anything that is something that is actor inspired.
Oh, yeah.
She added so many elements and so many layers to that character that were never on the page, never in the stage direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's very much similar to, what was it in Flatline? I forgot the writer on that one.
That was
Matheson. Yeah. But he was asked what was in the script for the Doctor's victory dance, and he said that was it, just victory dance. Everything else was Capaldi. So I can honestly see that being something that Gomez just, she was like, you know, I really need to do something here to drive the point home, and that worked.
Mm-hmm.
She's terrified.
One of the things you also notice, and it's subtle, or not necessarily subtle, but maybe not as overt, that she's wearing, you know, sort of the period costume for herself, you know, and it has a very prim and proper kind of appearance to it, the Scary Poppins kind of a look to it. But yet she is very animated,
mm-hmm.
as far as her mannerisms, as far as her gestures and things. And when she does that, and she does things like the little marionette dance or her little bananas head jerk and that sort of thing, it's juxtaposed against how proper her character is structured. I should say her physical character is structured, which just makes her even more unpredictable.
Yeah.
So there's just many layers of nutbag to that one.
Yeah, and just to go back to the master that we had previously with John Sim. I mean, he was great. I loved him. Don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. he was always one of those like, man, this guy is evil. I can't wait to see what he does next. You know, it was always an entertaining thing with him. Whereas Gomez was, I felt like with Missy, there were moments where I was like, man, I'm really worried about what she's gonna do next.
Yeah. No structure. She's completely off the script.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that I think in these cases, I think we've now been able to move away from the villain's exposition
mm-hmm.
because you don't always know that there's going to be a rigidly structured plan A, plan B, plan C. She's opportunistic and adaptable. So no question in my mind, obviously, we have not seen the last of her by a long shot. But I don't know that it's going to become what we had gotten a lot with Ainsley in his many, many recurrences as the Master, where it was just, okay, he's coming in, he's hell-bent on planetary domination, he's partnered up with this bunch of baddies this time, whoop, his plan went awry, they got him in a spaceship, he's ejected into space, we'll see him in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
Never going to get that out of Missy Gomez, ever.
No.
Nope.
And I think that's... As much as I love her, I hope that they use her very sparingly because it is such an entertaining character and because it is such so over the top and everything like that, it would be very, very easy to get burnt out on her.
Yeah.
So if they just bring her in every now and again when they really need to shake things up or something, that would be great. But using her just as a, oh, look, here's series finale. Let's bring the Master back again. It's right. Or God forbid they go back to the days of, you know, oh, look, it's Saturday. Must be a new Master episode.
All right. Well, that's a good segue into as far as, you know, when and how often are we going to be seeing the Master / Mistress again? But what are some other questions then that we're walking away from this series now still unresolved? Some things that we really think we may get answers to, not necessarily ones that we want to get answers to.
What the heck is going to happen with the Doctor and Clara? I mean, that's the big one that we're, and obviously we're supposed to be left with that, but you know, you can't help but sit there and wonder, just, are they going to be able to patch things up? And I think that it's great that, you know, all the rumors came out that she was going to leave, and then the fact that they're not saying anything about it.
Yeah.
Because now we're all sitting here just wondering, like, could this actually be the, because if the rumors hadn't come out, you know, the vast majority of us would probably be sitting here saying, oh no, they'll patch things up in the Christmas episode and then series 9, that everything will be great. But we're all in a state of wondering, like, is she going to leave?
What's
going to
happen next?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just as likely of one outcome versus the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because, I mean, I'm starting to wonder if this may not have been a plan at, you know, somebody said, hey, leak a rumor saying that she's going to leave because we want people questioning. Or it could have very well been that, you know, Jenna Coleman saying, you know what, the fans hate me. I don't know if I want to stick around with this. Let's see how things play out in Series 8, and we'll decide from there. So there's no way of telling what is actually going on here and what the outcome is going to be.
Mm.
Yeah. And then we still have the hanging Gallifrey question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that going to be, since we thought it was going to be a more prevalent point in 8, is this something that we're actually going to start to pursue in 9? Or has it just been determined by the stare into the emptiness for those few seconds that we really don't have a lead on anything? The Doctor has no pursuit of anything. We don't know if that had anything to do with what he was, you know, charting all over the chalkboards throughout the series. Is he going to go after it?
I wonder if that's going to be his gift from Santa. Like, you've been a good boy this year. You go on the nice list.
Here's a map.
I don't know, because I feel like it needs to be something that they do address early in the series 9, at least, because we went the entirety of series 8 before it got dropped, and now it got dropped again. It's like, okay, well, why now? What's the point of dropping it? Are you just trying to remind us of something that happened in the 50th, or is there an actual plan here? Mm-hmm. If we don't hear anything about it, I'd say in at least the first 4 episodes of series 9, then that's a serious misstep. I really want at least to get a name check in there. Have the Doctor be like, no, my spare time is all taken up by trying to figure out where this is. And
well, then you know, Moffat did say, and Moffat said it, so take it with a grain of salt, but he did say he had the end of series 9 planned out. I wonder if it's because Gallifrey is his plan for the end of the series.
That might very well be it.
Mm-hmm. He also said they were going to explain over the course of this series about the costume ring that Capaldi wears over his wedding ring.
Right.
It just occurred to me a little while ago, because someone had just kind of caught it and hadn't heard all the backstory, and I said, no, they fabricated this costume ring to go over his wedding band because he doesn't want to take it off, and Moffat had said at some point, and I think Capaldi had actually echoed it, that they were going to put something in there to sort of explain that in, and it was going to be an interesting or an enjoyable explanation as to how they were going to work it into the script. Nope.
It's in all that web content we're getting this season.
Yeah.
That was it. I must have missed the webisode.
I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they did have it and they worked it in there. And once they saw the whole script all put together, they realized, you know what? This really just stops the flow of everything. We need to take that out and make this a solid story.
Right. Or I wonder if it's, they were planning on the episodes running longer this year. I wonder if that made it go just enough too long that they were like, oh, we've got to lose something. And that's what went.
Well, there was that one line where he was talking about the fact that he had to live with a planet of otters for a year after he and River got in a fight. He could have just picked up his hand and wiggled his finger. I'd have gotten a fight with River. Oh, wedding band. I get it. Yeah,
but we would have felt cheated if that was the explanation, though. That's true.
We were just happy the fact that he name-checked her.
Oh, yeah. It's like, yeah, he said River.
Yeah, remember his wife? Yeah.
Well, he's had like 4 of them, apparently.
Right. So there's River. He married Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, Queen Elizabeth.
That was forced. It was a Rutan.
Susan's grandmother, maybe?
Yes, his home.
Possibly. And, somebody else.
Well, 2 millennia kicking around, eventually you're going to make a trip to Vegas. Didn't you get engaged to Marilyn Monroe at some point? Wasn't that a thing?
Wasn't there that one
Judy Garland
Christmas Carol episode? Didn't he end up accidentally marrying someone then?
Yeah, that was Marilyn Monroe, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Well,
so what did the peoples out there feel about the series in total?
The peoples had opinions. They kept them to themselves mostly, though.
Right.
Blue Seer got to us on Twitter and said, I love the way that this is structured because we challenged you, 140 characters or less to sum up Series 8. So Blue Seer
challenge accepted.
Said, new Doctor, dark and brilliant. Clara, too much Doctor. Danny, just plot device. Forest of the Night, beyond bad. Missy, yeah.
Done.
It almost feels like a disjointed haiku or something.
Or one of those sports announcers thing.
Yeah,
Packers win, Eagles lose.
So, the new Doctor was absolutely dark and brilliant. I love him to death. He's fantastic. I know that there's a lot of people that haven't made the transition to saying that he's absolutely brilliant, but I think that everyone at this point has gotten to the point where they're like, they at least accept him as the Doctor.
Yeah.
And if you haven't gotten to there, then clearly there's something wrong with you. He doesn't have to be your favorite.
But he is the Doctor.
Yes.
I will say there are still some folks out there that sort of go through the series a little more casually. They'll pick an episode here and there, and they'll watch one every couple of weeks for time schedules or whatever the case may be. And from what they've seen, they're like, well, I really don't know what to think of him yet, but what I have seen has been really interesting.
Okay.
And if that's all they've got out of it at this point, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Because he's got their interest.
Yeah. And then the Clara, too much Doctor. At times, yeah. At times, I feel like it was a little bit too much, but there were times where she really did need to step up and be the Doctor.
It showed to me the fact that she had really committed herself to him because she had locked all of this into her memory. She knows him, and the fact that she could sit there like in Death in Heaven can rattle off all the facts as if she were giving, you know, Tennant's line, I'm a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey, Constellation Castor Averroes, I'm 903 years old. And, you know, but she had that kind of wrote down.
Yeah.
So that to me was sort of an endearing thing.
Yeah. The only two times that it really stood out to me were that speech in Death in Heaven and in Flatline, where she got to be the Doctor, but that was really necessary for the script, so I can't knock him for that one.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed her playing her part as the Doctor.
Yeah, because most of it was making fun of the Doctor.
I know. And him just being like, oh, when you get back in my TARDIS.
Why I oughta.
All right, so Danny, just plot device.
I can see the argument.
Yeah.
You could probably make some counterpoints on that to say that there was a little bit more to it. But essentially, yes, all characters are, to a certain degree, a plot device. That's why you have them in your story,
yeah,
to move your plot along. Question is whether or not he had any merits beyond.
I felt like he got enough character development to actually be a fully idealized character. You know, he was a character in his own right. Yes, clearly he was only there because of Clara. You know, otherwise we wouldn't have needed to know anything about him. But because he was such a part of Clara's life, he was important. We did, and it wasn't just, oh, I have a boyfriend that I have to go back and see, and then you get into conflicts every now and again. There was enough of him that was built up in his backstory and things like that to justify him being there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yes, he was. It wouldn't have been an issue had Clara not started dating him, but because he did, they did at least give him something to go on. So, then Forced of the Night Beyond Bad.
Okay.
Granted.
It wasn't a good episode. It wasn't a bad episode.
No, it was. It was there. But
that's definitely an episode we watched.
Yeah. And then clearly, yes, we did agree with you on Missy. So there
yes, we go. Missy. Fantastic. Perfect.
And then Phil wrote in and said, enjoyable first three quarters of the series. The stories, the Doctor and Clara were all interesting. Was let down by the last three episodes.
Hmm.
Okay. The Force of the Night, it was an episode. Yeah.
But understand. I really enjoyed the two-part finale.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reason why I enjoyed it so much was because of the tension set up at the very beginning of Darkwater. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Danny dying, Clara being utterly distraught, and, you know, threatening to destroy the keys to the TARDIS kind of thing. Like, that all worked really well for me. Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, I think, was pretty much just, okay, what's Missy going to do next?
Yeah. Okay. Was Phil one of the listeners that never bought into the Clara-Danny relationship?
Yeah, I don't know, but that's a good possibility.
Yeah, because if you didn't buy that relationship, then yeah, I can see why the finale would not work for you.
Right. Well, the other folks that didn't quite lock into the finale, there's a certain percentage of them that just dumped on it because it was Moffat material. And right. Just in general, just that amount, that seething hatred. And
right. If we don't love Moffat, we have to explain why we hate him.
Right. Nobody doesn't dislike Moffat just because of who he is. That's not the case.
But there are other folks who had a bit of an issue with the fact that it was such a grand scale pair of episodes. You know, they were trying to tackle this massive thing, whereas all of the other episodes prior did have their individual merits, but they were very encapsulated, and they did a nice job of saying, all right, here's your threat, we address it, we deal with it, end of episode, little segue to get us into the next. New threat, new deal, new solution. Whereas this one went big scale and said, all right, here's all those little hints we gave you all along. We're going to tie them all together. We're going to pump them full of steroids. We're going to give you bring back our Cybermen. We're going to make them 10 times creepier again. Everything's big, 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 big. And some viewers just said, you know what? I prefer the smaller, digestible adventures.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what Phil was going for. I'm just saying that that's some of the arguments I've been hearing from other people who weren't terribly pleased with the two-part finale.
That makes sense. Yeah. Well, apparently there were 7.6 million people that watched the finale, and the final viewing figures were 7.6 million, which, again, outside of Deep Breath, was the highest of the final viewing figures, aside from, well, Deep Breath and Listen actually had more. But the AI on Death in Heaven was only 83, which, ironically, was the same as in The Forest of the Night. So I don't know how much stock I put in this, because...
So what you're trying to say here is that all these numbers that Keir can't stand mean absolutely nothing.
Well, then you're going to enjoy next week's episode where I do a statistical analysis of all the numbers this season.
We're going to do a complete breakdown.
Yes, yep. With a shared white screen, for those of you who are listening, you'll be able to get the actual flow charts and spreadsheets involved that Haley will be pointing to.
Right. There's going to be a whole PowerPoint. It's going to be great.
No, but the interesting thing is, if you look at the final viewing figures, though, like, so Death in Heaven had 7.6 million and an AI of 83. Listen, which, you know, across the board has been one of the highest ranked episodes throughout the whole series, had 7.8 million people and an AI of 82. So an audience appreciation less than in The Forest of the Night. Hey.
Is the AI just how much it's being, like, talked about on social media and stuff?
I honestly don't know. I have not been able to figure out where they get this figure from.
But because a really hated episode would probably get talked about a lot, if that's what it is.
Well, no, because, I mean, Kill the Moon got 82. Robots of Sherwood got 82. So they're, I don't know.
It's just a number means nothing.
Oh, don't worry about it, Kier. The series is over. We don't have to talk about it again until
Christmas.
Kier's
just mad because he only got a 79.
Did. I don't have enough Google clout.
Oh, yeah. But then, so we've got just a few more weeks until we get to talk about stats again, because we've got the Christmas special coming up. And the Children in Need special that came on had a preview of it.
Yeah, which and Clara did not is help in our it. Question factors. Yeah. Which Clara? I don't know.
Oh, God, that conversation went on way too long between our group of friends.
Because and why is the doctor wearing a hoodie?
Honestly, I'm wondering, was that the same, like, black shirt that he'd been wearing that had, like, this? I don't even know what kind of design it had.
Oh, his sparkly sweater?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, I'm like, you know, I don't remember ever seeing him from the back when he wore that. Like,
No. That was just a pullover, just a cardigan thing. No, This thing had a hood.
Well, it's the one he was wearing at Time Heist. So, you know, this is in the midst of him running back and forth between placing all that stuff and playing the architect.
Wait, what color was his tie?
That'll explain everything. Did the light bulbs just flicker? I swear to God.
Was he wearing a watch?
Not Penny's boat.
So this was just a great little way of, like, building the tension and showing some of the humor that we're going to be getting, getting to see Dan Starkey playing an elf.
Yeah. So you can never let the poor guy get out of the prosthetics chair. You know, he just give him one episode where he does not have to sit in makeup for 3 hours.
Can I just have a day off? Fine. Put these ears on.
Damn it. These things smell like Spock.
So, I mean, there's clearly some kind of relationship between the Doctor and Santa. Like, I mean, at the end of the finale, he had that great, like, Tennant-esque look on his face, like, what the heck? But here we're seeing that there's clearly some kind of understanding who the other one is.
Right. You can't tell if it's overt animosity. They're not really threatening each other, but they're both being sort of very serious with one another. I don't know.
Pay attention to what I am saying. I'm just, from the little teaser that we got, and then from seeing this, I think that this will probably be one of the standout Christmas episodes. I know that's a lot to put on, what, a grand total of, like, 75 seconds of footage. Mm-hmm. But it just seems like they know what they're doing with this one. There seems to be a plan.
Well, of course, we live in a world of superlatives. The best, most awesome superlatives. So.
Yeah. Oh, and then some other news that we've got is apparently Stephen Moffat took a moment to talk about Series 8 and discuss some of the things that have been going on the social medias and things.
Really, really useful information. It was sort of a discussion with Boyd Hilton of Heat Magazine, sort of put together a Q&A with Moffat, where he actually did share some information retrospectively. You know, you can't really rely on him too much about projecting what you're going to get from him. But looking back, he sort of revels a little bit in being able to say, you know, see, here's what I did. Wasn't I clever?
Yeah.
So, and that's what a lot of this was. This was sort of the look back on, you know, his casting decisions, the what we had been led at the beginning of the series to believe that we were going to be getting longer scene cuts and those things. And he's now sort of leading us to believe that wasn't actually the case. And it was the power of suggestion. Take what you want out of that. Definitely worth looking over this. We'll share it in the link notes as always. But just to see what his explanations of his role as the showrunner, which we've always been kind of curious about, mm-hmm. when he puts on one hat versus another, that position entails. Even down to things like the editing of the trailers, you know, and choosing what goes into next week's little stings, and whether or not you're going to use that as an opportunity to try and win viewership, or if you're just doing it to mess with your viewers. There is no Clara Oswald. There's never been a Clara Oswald bit. So good, good stuff to read over. I really enjoyed the article.
You know, one of the things that I really enjoyed about it was they had asked him about the leaked episodes, you know, the first episodes that came out in the series. And he said, to be honest, I don't blame the guys who went and looked, because I would have. And he said, I would have as a fan. It would have ruined it for me. It would have ruined it for me, but a new doctor, I'd have to go and take a look. He said they've at least learned something, which is what the episodes look like when we sign off on them. Right. So, you know, he's like, you know, at least they understand the process that goes into making the show now. And, you know, not criticizing anyone that you know, cheated and went and looked at it early, like some French people that we know who will remain nameless.
Who do you mean?
Ooh?
I don't know who.
He also, you know, he acknowledges that we all know he's lying to us, like 80% of the time. He says in the script, Michelle Gomez says she's a random access neural interface, and the letters for that spell out Ronnie, and we were supposed to get it, and none of us did.
He's just functioning on a higher level, most of us.
He's too clever for us.
As Jay alluded to before, you know, as far as the, you know, our anger over the Osgood murder, but he does give some explanation as to why he put that in there, and it wasn't just, you know, strictly a matter of screwing with the viewers or trying to, you know, do a Joss Whedon on us or things. It was just as Jay had said, it's an idea of making sure the Master is genuinely a menacing threat and an unpredictable threat. And if you have to really sell the fact that she is inherently evil, rather than just being, you know, kooky and unpredictable and kind of a little risky, you've got to roll the hard six and do something that's going to anger the viewers potentially, because it sells the character.
Mm-hmm. And it really worked. Oh, so what's some of the other news that we've got going on here?
Toys.
Lots of toys. Tis the season.
Yeah, exactly.
Good news about toys and not as good news about toys.
Good news
first? Which do you want first? Good news first.
Okay. I got a Pop Funko figure for Christmas already, and I was like, I wonder what else is out there, and I went looking for Doctor Who Pop Funkos, and apparently they are coming soon, but not in time for Christmas.
When will now be then?
In 2015.
Soon.
Soon, okay. But not now. Now is not then yet.
Okay.
As soon as I saw these, I was like, yep, nope, I need these. I need some.
We're going to get 10th, 11th, 12th, and 4th Doctors, along with the TARDIS, the Weeping Angel, and a Dalek.
Yep, I will have all of them.
And we've got a little concept art here, so you can see how much he wants them.
Right. Well, not as great news, the approval that we had gotten a few months back from the now renamed Lego R&D department, is that because they are still doing evaluations on the two approved early Doctor Who Lego sets, things have not progressed any farther. So they have to determine whether or not they're going to approve one or the other as complete sets, whether they're going to take aspects from both to merge them into one approved series to build upon, and so forth. So as a result of the ongoing evaluations, there's no way we're going to see them in time for Christmas for this year, and nothing anticipatory into 2015. So hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
Get your Pop Funko figures while you're waiting.
Yes, play with them.
I've got to say, I'm a little bit sad about this because I would love it, but at the same time, Legos are really expensive. Yeah. So, I don't know if I'd have gotten them first thing out of the box anyway. I don't know. It'll be nice to see if they actually do wind up coming out, then I have an excuse to buy Legos again.
Well, I'm doing it for the kids, of course.
Right.
But they totally need more. That giant bucket in their room isn't nearly full enough.
Nope. I can still see room at the top.
All right. So you guys have anything to say wrapping up here?
Just really, really pleased. I guess I'll be rewatching just for fun.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Absolutely. All right. Well, this has been episode 112 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying 5.5 weeks to go.
But who's counting?
Exactly.
This is Kira saying, it's a time machine. It also travels in space, and it usually contains a man who just wants to get on with his work, preventing the end of the world, but keeps getting interrupted by boring little humans.
And this is Haley saying, nobody likes the tangerines.
Satsumas. It's a Satsuma.
We'll see you guys next week.
Miles.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also go to GunnaGeek.com to check out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.